I was going to start out this morning with a question, and given what has happened, I didn't know if it was really appropriate to ask it, but I think I will anyway. And that question is simply, are you happy? There are some who have talked about, you know, after the last couple of days, you know, I feel tired. I feel baffled. Maybe even I just feel desensitized, or I feel apathetic, or I just feel numb. I don't really know what I feel, if I'm really feeling anything. But I think it's important for us to ask this question, are you happy? Because it is a weird and oftentimes maybe even annoying question. You know how some of us will ask, you know, hey, how are you doing? Or, you know, that specifically, you know, are you happy? Because what are you supposed to say? No. Because then if you do say no, that probably means that you don't necessarily want to talk about what makes you unhappy. But then you kind of have to, because you've just opened that gate of conversation. And usually the person who asks us that question is not the one that we just kind of want to spill our guts out to, right? And in fact, there may be that person who we hope will ask us that question, because that's the one who we want to talk to. That's the one who we want to unload on and vent and just express our frustration, because we know that that person will understand. And it just aches our heart when that person does not ask us how we are doing or if we are happy. We are craving for that one person who will understand. A couple of weeks ago, I think at this point, Time Magazine had a cover that talked about the new antidepressant. And in the midst of this article, it was showing a whole bunch of statistics that really spoke to me. I'm not really a numbers guy, but these particularly just kind of jumped out at me. It said that 12% of Americans took antidepressants, that the global revenue for antidepressants was about $14.5 billion in 2014, and it was estimated to go up to $17 billion over the next 3 years. That 6.7% of Americans suffer from clinical depression, about 16 million people. A growing number of those people also include children and teenagers. They said it is the leading cause of disability in the world, and this is the one that really got me, costing the U.S. economy alone $210 billion a year in lost productivity. So in other words, missed days off of work, care for physical illness, for mental illness, things related to depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, migraines, and sleep disorders. So because of all of that, we have lost about $210 billion in productivity. And I think the reason this spoke out to me is because, you know, a lot of the conversations and questions the last several months has been, you know, how do we get our people back to work? You know, how do we boost the economy? And this made me think, well, how can we do that if so many of our people are unhappy, if they're lacking that focus and just that basic strength? The article went on to say that there has not been a major depression drug breakthrough in nearly three decades. Not that it's really all about medication, but some of us may know how important that is. Also important how things like exercise and maybe talk therapy, mindfulness, how these things can help us influence our mood, influence our behavior, our way of life. But we're also seeing that technology, for example, in all of its advancements, in all of its conveniences, it does not seem to fill this void that we have, or at least like we thought we would. These fixes are not fixing us. Perhaps we don't know how to be happy because maybe sometimes we simply don't know what happiness is. There was a psychiatrist who was once talking with their patient, listening to them about, they were saying how unhappy they were and what they wanted, what they needed to get that way. And they said, you know, if you're so focused on your idea of what happiness is, you're going to miss a lot of joy that comes through your life. Because it's not about being in love with the idea of happiness. It is about seeing how happiness exists in the world and how we can be a part of it. So how do we be a part of that happiness, of that joy? This is one of the reasons that we are looking at the five marks of a United Methodist. So the writer of this book, Dr. Steve Harper, asked this question, what role does joy play in following Christ? He writes simply this, discipleship is a whole life response to grace. We fail to grasp what God is offering us when we limit it to the cognitive element, which is kind of a big word way of saying that we tend to speak a lot of our heads, through our heads and to our heads, and sometimes we neglect speaking from the heart. And we neglect speaking to the heart because maybe sometimes it's kind of embarrassing that maybe we will be thought of as anti-intellectual or not smart enough to talk as though we have prepared, as though we have a lot of articulation that we can bring, that we have formed our thoughts and we can present them in a very intellectual kind of way. We don't want to seem like those folks who maybe aren't as intelligent. But the cost of this sometimes is that when we don't speak from the heart, when we don't speak to the heart, we are disconnecting ourselves from a very important part of our humanity. Jesus spoke to people's intellect. We know this is true. He was a very intellectual and very studied person, but he also spoke to people's hearts. He used imagery. He used poetry. He told stories. He showed people that they could experience God not just through statements and rules and doctrine and theology, but through a living experience. It was through this living experience that they were able to find strength and joy. Joy, Harper writes in the Five Marks, is the word used by Christians in every age to describe the comprehensive response that we make out of our whole being in God's grace. In other words, we speak from our hearts, we speak from our minds, we speak from our stories and our experiences. We speak out of our entire humanity because we realize that God affects us, our humanity, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's part of being a disciple. We are always presently aware of God in our lives and how that reflects our lives. And we do all of this actively. We are actively joyful. This kind of joy, of course, is not an emotion. It's not just that feeling that we have, because we all know in our heads that happiness comes and it goes. It's kind of like what Dennis Leary once said. It comes in small doses. Perhaps part of our endless search is that we are constantly looking for that infinite dose of happiness, whatever that thing is going to be that will give us that infinite feeling of happiness and joy. Unfortunately, it does not exist. But that is the difference between happiness and joy. And so this verse that we see in Nehemiah, chapter 8, verse 10, that the joy of the Lord is our strength, it comes attached to this passage where the Israelites were not feeling very joyful. They were not happy at all. They were coming in the time of being welcomed back to their home in Jerusalem after they had been held captive and exiled in the place of Babylon, where the Babylonians had come and just completely defeated them, destroyed their buildings, destroyed their religious symbols. Their way of life was no more. And so after many, many years, they're finally being able to be released. They're freed. They're going back, but they're having a hard time reconnecting. They're trying to figure out how they can belong to this place once again, how they can be the people who they once were. And in the midst of this, they have this kind of celebration, except nobody is celebrating. The prophet Ezra has come back as well. They are all meeting in Jerusalem. And so this prophet Ezra, he starts reading from the book of the law of Moses. How fun is that, right? All of these laws, telling them, reminding them what it means to be God's people. So in order to be a follower of God, in order to be God's chosen, right, you had to follow all of those rules, all of those 600 plus rules. And when the people are hearing this, they are crying out in sorrow and broken hearts, because to them, what they think Ezra is saying is, here's how you've messed up. Here's how you have fallen. Here's how you have not been the people that you were supposed to be. And they cry out in sorrow and lament. But then Nehemiah steps in. Now, Nehemiah is the governor of these people. He was here to be a part of this ceremony, and he sees how the people are just crying out in this sorrow. And he stands up and he says, this wasn't what we intended. This wasn't meant to tell you how bad you are or how much you have broken the law or how many mistakes you made. That's not what it's about. It's about reminding you. It's about reminding you who you are. This is who you are. And whether or not you live up to that is not the point. The point is God is welcoming you back home. You are back home. They are God's people. And because of this, Nehemiah said, it is time to rejoice. Rejoice because you are welcomed back. This day is holy to the Lord your God, Nehemiah says. Do not mourn. Do not weep. Go eat and drink. Send portions of what you have to those who don't, to remind them that they too are God's people. Do not be grieved, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. Harper writes, joy is a mark of discipleship that gives us confidence and courage. Now, this is an essential ingredient for us because as long as we evaluate our Christian life, or really just life in general, in terms of other people, in terms of what other people think of us, we are always going to be falling short. We are always going to be trying so much for so long to be the people that everybody else thinks that we should be, and not focusing on who God has already created us to be. Perfect love, Harper writes, is the genesis of courage. It is different from a bull in a china shop kind of spirituality which claims to be courageously prophetic when really it is just obnoxious. Instead of this, we live in joyful peace, knowing that when we are faithful to God, we are living not only as God intends, but we are doing so in the right spirit. That right spirit is a spirit of peace. Peace in who we are, peace in the knowledge of who God has made us to be, and that God loves us. And I love this description because it reminds us that our joy in God doesn't have anything to do with convincing anybody else that we are right in what we believe. Our being right in our faith in Christ doesn't have anything to do with proving someone else that they are wrong. I remember when the movie Return of the King came out back in 2003, and it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. My college friends and I even skipped a class to go to this. I skipped a final. It's okay. It was one of those where they said, you know, if you're happy with your grade, you don't have to take it, and I was fine with a C, so... And so we went, and it was great. We saw all the movies back to back, and the last one, you know, was just awesome. And I remember, you know, coming back into town and a few weeks later, and I was telling somebody about it, and they said, oh, I thought that was horrible. You know, it was way too long. There were too many endings, and it was just boring. And, you know, I had that instinct to argue with him, right? Because I had to convince him that I was right and he was wrong. And then all of a sudden, in lieu of nothing, this peace just came over me when I realized it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that he hated it or he thought it was too long or too boring or whatever. That doesn't change the experience that I had. And that's kind of a superficial example, I know. But what it taught me was somebody else's opinion does not need to influence the experience that I have had in my life. If we have a loving relationship with God, with Jesus Christ, who reminds us who we are, who we belong to, and that who we are is holy, because of who has created us? Why should another opinion, a disagreeable opinion, change that? We should be joyful in who we are as who God has made us to be. And we can hear those arguments that life is not fair, that we cannot be happy all the time, that life is a struggle, and that's all true. But if we hear that enough times, that becomes the default to the way that we see the world. It becomes the standard to how we live in the world and how it governs and directs everything that we do in our lives in the midst of humanity. Absolutely, life is hard. And we all know that it is harder for some than it is for others. But what is that joy that gives us strength to realize and understand and to live within the reality that we see around us, but to do so with another reality in focus? That even when those times exist where we feel alone and defeated and unworthy, we remember that we are more than this because we have been created by someone who knows us, who lives with us, and who loves us. Many of you probably know Max Lucado's story, You Are Special. This is a story that my wife and I, Morgan, would read to our son, Ben, over and over and over. I think one of the reasons that we did that, or at least one of the reasons I did that, is because sometimes I needed to hear that story more than my son did. So for those of you who have not heard this story, I want to share some excerpts of it with you. For those of you who have, please just bear with me. But I hope that maybe it speaks to you the way that it often speaks to me. The Wemmicks were a small wooden people. These little wooden people were carved by a woodmaker named Eli. Eli's workshop sat on a hill overlooking the Wemmick village. Every one of these Wemmicks was different. Some had big noses, others had large eyes, some were tall, and others were short. Some wore hats, others wore coats, but all were made by the same carver and all lived in the same village. All day long, every day, the Wemmicks did the same thing. They gave each other stickers. Every Wemmick had a box of Golden Star stickers and a box of dull gray dot stickers. Up and down the streets, all over the city, people could be seen sticking gold stars or gray dots onto each other. The pretty ones, those with smooth wood and fine paint, always got shiny stars. But if the wood was rough or the paint was chipped, the Wemmicks gave dull gray dots. The talented ones got stars too. Some could lift big sticks high above their heads or jump over tall boxes. Still others knew big words or could sing very pretty songs. Everyone gave them shiny gold stars. Some Wemmicks had stars all over them. Every time they got a star, it made them feel so good that they did something else and got another star. There were many other Wemmicks that could do very little, and they all got dull gray dots. There was one little Wemmick, and his name was Punchinello. He tried to jump high like the others, but he always fell. And when he fell, the others would gather around him and give dull gray dots. Sometimes when he fell, it would scar his wood, so the people would give him more gray dots. He would try to explain why he fell, and in doing so, he would say something really silly. Then the Wemmicks would give him even more gray dots. After a while, Punchinello had so many dots that he didn't want to go outside. He was afraid he would do something dumb, such as forget his hat or step in the water, and then people would give him more gray dots. In fact, he had so many gray dots that some people would come up to him and just give him one without any reason. "He deserves a lot of dots," they would say. The wooden people would agree with one another. "He is not a good wooden person." After a while, Punchinello believed them. "I am not a good Wemmick," he said to himself. The few times he went outside, he hung around other Wemmicks who had a lot of gray dots. At least he felt better around them. But then one day, Punchinello met a Wemmick who was unlike any he had ever met. She had no dull gray dots. She did not have any shiny gold stars. She was a wooden Wemmick, and her name was Lucia. It wasn't that people didn't give her stickers. It was just that the stickers did not stick on her. Some admired her for having no dots, so they would run up and give her a star, but it would fall off. Some would look down on her for having no stars, so they would give her a dot, but that would not stick either. "That's the way I want to be," thought Punchinello. "I don't want anyone's marks." So he asked the stickerless Wemmick how she did it. "It's easy," she replied. "Every day I go see Eli." Punchinello asked Eli, "Who's Eli?" She replied, "He is the woodcarver. I sit in his workshop and spend time with him." Punchinello asked, "Why do you do that?" Lucia told him, "Why don't you go find out for yourself? Go up the hill and visit him. He's there right now." And with that, the sweet little Wemmick turned and skipped away. "But what if he doesn't want to see me?" Punchinello cried out to her, but she didn't hear him. So Punchinello went home. He sat near a window and watched the wooden people as they scurried about, giving each other gold stars and gray dots. "It's not right," he muttered to himself. Then he resolved to go see Eli after all. Punchinello walked up the narrow path to the top of the hill and stepped into the big woodcarver shop. His little wooden eyes widened at the size of everything. The stool was as tall as he was. He had to stretch on his tippy toes to see the top of the workbench. A hammer was as long as his arm. Punchinello swallowed hard and thought to himself, "I'm not staying here," and he turned to leave. And then he heard his name. "Punchinello," said a voice deep and strong. He stopped. The voice said, "Punchinello, how good of you it is to come. Let me have a look at you." Punchinello slowly turned around and looked at the large bearded craftsman and said, "You know my name?" "Of course I do," the maker said. "I made you." All of a sudden, Eli stooped down and picked the little Punchinello and sat him up on the workbench. The maker spoke thoughtfully as he inspected the gray circles all over him. "It looks like you have been given some pretty bad marks." Punchinello said quickly, "I didn't mean to, really, I didn't. I tried really hard not to." The maker said, "Oh, you don't have to defend yourself to me. I don't care what the other Wemmicks think." Punchinello asked, "Really, you don't?" Then Eli said, "No, and you shouldn't either. Who are they to give you stars or dots? They are Wemmicks just like you. What they think doesn't really matter at all, Punchinello. All that matters is what I think, and I think you are special." Punchinello laughed. "Me special? How can I be special? I can't do anything. I can't walk fast. I can't jump. My paint is scratched and peeling. I make silly mistakes all the time, and I am not a beautiful Wemmick like some of the others. How could I possibly matter to you?" Eli looked at Punchinello and put his hands on those little wooden shoulders, and he spoke very slowly. "Because you are mine. That is why you matter to me." Punchinello had never had anyone look at him this way before or say anything so nice, much less his maker. "Punchinello, every day I have been waiting and hoping that you would come to see me." Punchinello looked up at him and said, "Well, I came because I met a sweet Wemmick girl who had no marks." Eli said, "I know, Lucia told me all about you." "Why don't the stickers stay on her?" Punchinello asked. "Because she has decided," Eli said, "that what I think is more important than what anyone else thinks. The stickers only stick if you let them." Punchinello looked puzzled and said, "What do you mean?" Eli said, "The stickers only stick if they matter to you. The more you trust in my love, the less you will care about those stickers." Punchinello said, "I'm not really sure I understand what you mean." The maker said, "You will, but it will take time. You have a lot of marks. So for now, just come to see me every day and let me remind you how much I care about you." Eli lifted Punchinello off the bench and set him on the floor. "Now remember," Eli said, as the little Wemmick walked out the door, "you are special because I made you, and I don't make mistakes." Punchinello left Eli's house, but in his heart he thought, "I think he really means it." And when he thought this, one of the dots fell off. There are going to be those days when we do not feel happy, when we feel, in fact, the exact opposite because of life. But even on those days, we can live a life of joy, not as an emotion, but as a truth. That no matter how many times we fall, no matter how many times we scuff ourselves or make mistakes, no matter how many times others may mark us, we have been made by a God who loves us for who we are. Sometimes the greatest way we can share that joy with others is to simply allow others to see how we are living that life of joy. Other times it is telling our story, the story of who we are and from whom we have come. That is how we show our true marks. We are reminded this is a sacred day. It is a holy day. It is a day where God is present. So no matter what may be going on in your lives, whether it's a time of celebration or a time of hardship, joy can be found even in the midst of whatever it is that we go through. So let us go, knowing there is a difference between simply being happy and leading a joyful life, where that joyful life comes in our Creator, who does not make mistakes, who creates us as we are supposed to be and loves us. Let us keep our hearts and minds open to that message and not keep it to ourselves, but to take it out into a world that also needs to know that they too are loved for who they are. We have received that good news today as the crumbs remind us something has happened here. Christ has been here and Christ goes with us. So go in the spirit of Christ, knowing that our lives are lives to be joyful. Let us go eat, drink, celebrate, share with those who have none. Let us live a life that rejoices in God. Go in that peace. Amen.